All right, we're going to get going again now. Are there any questions on things talked about in that first hour? I will assume that means there are no questions. All right, I want to talk about states of hypercoagulation. We were looking at things where the coagulation system is faulty. Some aspect of it is either platelets or clotting factors or something of that kind that leads to it. But what about situations where we have excessive clotting? And that certainly does happen. If we take a look at, I mentioned something to do with kind of like a meltdown where you have activated factors drifting away from an area. Well, what more likely happens, that actually doesn't happen very often, the aspect of a formed blood clot causing a runaway coagulation event is actually almost never heard of, because that system keeping things localized is pretty good. But some things that can change in the system that will produce, that can run, result in that, have to do with exposure of a lot of collagen in basement membranes because of endothelial cell injury and death, say like in the case of what we call sepsis with overwhelming infections, or where we have some of that tissue factor. Remember, we mentioned the tissue factor always stays in the tissue space, and the blood has to come to it to basically activate the clotting system. If we get tissue factor leaking into the circulatory system, it will trigger a runaway clotting event. And in that situation, everything as the blood is circulating, proteins are activating and working on one another, and literally is kind of like a nuclear meltdown. And that's referred to as disseminated intravascular coagulation. It's abbreviated DIC. And nobody just shows up in the emergency room, you know, and says, hey, I think I got DIC going on, let's get on with this thing, you know. It's always a complication of something really seriously wrong. Obstetrical disaster, by that I mean a dead fetus or leakage of amniotic fluid into the circulatory system. Mothers, see, that amniotic fluid has a very powerful anticoagulant in it, and you sort of want mom's blood to clot, at least at the uterus, when the kid's born and the placenta tears away from the uterine wall. So you need to have that, the clotting system's got to work for you right then. But if some of that amniotic fluid gets into mom's circulation system, it will trigger a runaway clotting event. That's the tissue thromboplastin. You'll see the other one is massive muscle injury. People who have crush injuries, bad car accidents, and you have a lot of tissue thromboplastin from the muscle or the bone getting into the circulatory system, it's going to trigger that factor 7. And so what you're going to have then is a runaway clotting event. Frequently what we will see is either obstetrical disaster or a consequence of some kind of sepsis, that is to say infection in the blood itself, that leads to endothelial injury, and a lot of endothelial cells die all over the body at once. And so there's tons of exposed collagen every place, even though there's really no vascular breakage. And then the clotting factors adhere there, start the process, and it's going on all over the place. And so you end up with little strings of clot in the circulation. They clot up the kidneys, they'll clot off the glomerulus. Plus you're using up all your clotting proteins in this kind of runaway, frivolous kind of exercise. So if you do spring a leak someplace, which you're going to, you have no clotting proteins really to go to work. You just consume them all. So it's a consumptive process. And this chart is sort of showing the various ways in which this, whether it's leakage of sepsis, whether it's, which is a form of endothelial injury. But once it gets started, effectively, the process is just like we talked about in terms of healthy hemostasis. It's just that it's running all over in all the vessels as the blood is being pumped. And that's going to lead to lots of small vessel occlusion as well as bleeding, because you just used up, in a heartbeat, you just used up all your clotting factors. So there's not enough around when you really need it. Very serious problem. Other forms of hypercoagulation are quite fascinating, and that is where somebody has an isolated blood clot. Now, if you're on an airplane and you're traveling someplace, they probably tell you if it's any length of time at all, you know, drink a fair bit of water, get up and move around, because you don't want clots forming in your legs as you're, you know, sitting there in a fixed position. Well, what are some of the things that really contribute to that? Most of the clots, yes, they do occur in the deep leg veins because our leg veins have valves in them. You might be aware of that. But the reason all of my blood doesn't rush to my legs in the venous side of the circulation because I'm standing is that my leg veins have valves, and they actually close up. But look, we all have little valves like that, and people who don't have those, and there are, who didn't have those developmentally, they do pass out. They have to get up very slowly. They learn what they've got to do to actually get up into an erect position to keep from passing out, having all their blood cool in their legs and, you know, get lightheaded. So these little leg veins turn out to be the source of the problem, where we have blood clot actually beginning, typically right here behind those cusps. Well, what is it that makes this happen? This is always a problem of, really, of clotting factors. And we can have too thick of blood. That's one thing. We talked about polycythemia before. But increased clotting factor proteins. There's always a small amount of spontaneous activation, but we have a way of removing those. But if you've got way too many clotting proteins, like a woman who's pregnant will have, or a woman taking estrogen or birth control pills, we have an increase in the amount of clotting proteins. And the reason, again, is at the time of delivery, you want mom's clotting system highly tuned and ready to go. Again, you can't form a committee because if mom has a miscarriage or even a normal delivery, you could have a fatal hemorrhage there if you don't have adequate clotting, which Mother Nature has now realized means excessive clotting, really, for that transient period. And so increased clotting proteins will lead to something, a potential for this. Decreased braking forces, you're going to hear about protein C and protein S. You might already know about that, antithrombin 3, kinds of things that are involved in preventing clots, well, protein C and protein S, preventing clots from forming, antithrombin 3 to help them dissolve. And if there are defects there, you have all kinds of hypercoagulation. Endothelial injury, well, that sort of works itself back into the business of DIC in a way. One of the most interesting things here that's come along in a long time are genetic factors. The clotting factors that become activated have to be broken down. They're fairly short-lived, and they have to bind to their receptors. But once that they're active, they do their job, and then we kind of break them down, particularly ones that are at the end of the line. And factor 5 is one of those. If you remember the clotting cascade, it's right in the middle of the so-called final comma pathway. Well, there happens to be a genetic problem with a particular one, so named for the city in Leiden in Holland. And Leiden factor 5 is one that once you turn it on, you cannot turn it off. You can't get rid of it. The way we turn the proteins off is we degrade them. And the enzymes that break them down, like protein C and protein S, look for a specific point on that protein to start the cleavage process, to start breaking it down. If that part is missing, the active site doesn't know anything about that. The active site just keeps on working, and you can't break it down. Leiden factor 5 here is one of the most important causes of deep leg vein thrombosis in people of Northern European descent. And again, it's surprisingly surprising what percentage people carry that. So Leiden factor 5 is an interesting one because once the factor is activated, factor 5 is activated, you can't degrade it. That sucker is up and rolling and, you know, good luck. But generally speaking, things such as stasis play a very important role. Slow flow through here when you're sitting with a fixed, fixed position, your legs are flexed, the flow is slow to return from your legs, and there's always some spontaneous activation. So stasis plays a very important role, particularly in the thrombus that people develop getting on, on an airplane. They did a study of people who were coming in from Australia. This was in LA, at LAX, and people were getting off an airplane, just arrived from Australia, and they were signing them up. I don't know what they were giving them. You know, they got something to allow them to go ahead and do an ultrasound of their deep leg veins. And it was something like 20% got off the airplane with deep leg vein thrombosis. But they weren't developing pulmonary emboli. They weren't breaking free, evidently. But it was astonishing to see how many people, and they had a control population who had not flown for 22 hours, who didn't have that problem. So they were fairly certain it was there. So stasis, slow flow of the blood, well, there's always some spontaneous activation. And part of the movement of the blood sort of mixes the proteins up so they can't really go to work on each other. And the stasis in particular right back in here is what starts the clot formation. And so what this is demonstrating is a little clot in and around here, because then it sort of grows and proliferates. So stasis plays an important role in hypercoagulation. Increased number of clotting proteins plays a role. Endothelial injury and genetic factors, if you got one of these, if you're a carrier of factor 5 Leiden. All right, stasis, I would say, is probably the most common thing, because it doesn't really, anybody can have that develop. All right, so at any rate, so if you're on a long airline flight or something, or driving country, get out and walk around every now and then is the message. Okay, we're going to move on to lymph nodes. Any questions on the clotting system? Okay, Lymph node pathology is, I mean, the scary part of it, of course, would be malignancies that arise in there. As we know, lymph nodes will filter out lots of things, including malignant cells from other organs. And so we see metastasis of breast cancer, lung cancer, prostate cancer, all that kind of stuff to the regional lymph nodes. But that isn't a cancer. It's not a malignancy that develops there. It's just that it got trapped there and then it continued to grow. We're going to be taking a look at things that occur in the lymph nodes that arise in the lymph nodes from the lymphocytes that are there. This is basic nodal architecture right here. We have lymph glands all over, they're called lymph nodes, all over our body that are filtering the lymphatic fluid. It's coming back. We have all kinds of bacteria that get trapped and stuff like that. And the lymphatic fluid is coming in, seeping in from all these sources on the outer convexity of the lymph node. The lymphatic fluid sort of percolates through the lymph node. The lymphocytes, macrophages, are looking for non-self antigens. We're going to be producing antibodies here. At least we're going to start the process here. And we're going to, you know, if we have bacteria, we're going to engulf and kill them if they happen to be in the floating in the lymphatic fluid. And the lymphatic fluid is eventually going to percolate and come back out the hilum of the lymph node here. And then it's going to continue on back and the fluid will then be restored to the vascular system. Remember, the lymphatic fluid accumulates, it gets out there because there's always some seepage of fluid from the cardiovascular system out into the tissue space. And just the muscle action we have moving around sort of serves as the pumping action to push the lymphatic fluid along. But it represents fluid that extravasated from, seeped out of our blood vessels and bathed the cells, and then it gets returned and gets filtered through these guys. So we're looking here at things that are going to occur. Let's just take a look at some of the things that happen in a lymph node. We'll take a look at a real lymph node here. And this is more or less the same thing. And here we have some germinal centers. And again, the lymphatic fluid comes in and eventually goes out here. And we have germinal centers that are forming in here because this person was making antibodies to something. And that's what those represent. They're non-antigens, non-self antigens, that the lymphocytes are responding to, and they're making antibodies in there. So that's kind of what's going on there. So lymph nodes we see are kind of maybe reactive. It's a healthy process. Even though they swell up and get red and they're painful, we know that they're doing their job. And sometimes they do develop abscesses, and then we have to do something about it. But at any rate, this right here would be kind of a healthy lymph node that was basically working for whoever it was. When we think about lymph node disorders, then the real distinction is between something that is reactive versus neoplastic. Again, we'll sort of leave out of that the picture, the idea that lymph nodes do trap malignant cells, circulating malignant cells from other sources, and can become involved that way. We're going to look at things that are primary. Reactive means that it is responding. It's responding to infectious agent. It may actually also be responding to tumors. Sometimes tumors that break down, there's a lot of garbage from dead cells that are sort of floating along in the fluid, and it reacts to that as well. Can be fairly nonspecific. So neoplastic, of course, is the something growing there, and it's not part of the normal expected process of identifying non-self and so on. The histologic pattern then plays a real important role. We just about have to have a biopsy. Occasionally, we can do it with a needle aspiration, but we prefer to get a biopsy, and we'll take a look at why, because it helps us determine what the from the nodal architecture, what's the most likely cell that's caused a neoplasia, that we can then do the better job of determining what chemotherapy needs to be like. The combination of radiation and chemotherapy in some cases. So the histologic pattern is real important, and you can't get that just from sucking cells up through a needle. What we look for in the nodal architecture will be effacement. Effacement means the face has been removed. If you chop somebody's face off, they ain't got no face left, all right? So if we go back and take a look at this, the nodal architecture in section has its own identifying features. It's like, you know, I got two eyes, a nose, ears, and that sort of thing, a really big nose. Okay, I got a big nose. I'm going to go on record with that one. But anyway, it's my defining feature. But you've got a nodal structure that you can recognize. It's got, you know, a nose and two eyes and ears, sort of. It's got sort of a capsule out here and a space below it, right here, the subcapsular sinus. We got germinal centers. We got a hilum and everything else. But at any rate, it does have some defining microarchitecture there. Effacement means that whatever's growing in there just runs over the entire thing, and it's a complete monomorphic monocellular replacement, and all that structure is now missing. It's all solid, and everybody looks exactly like their neighbor. That's effacement. The normal expected architectural features are missing. So effacement's an important thing. If we see inflammatory changes that are like abscess or very reactive, lots and lots of germinal centers, well, that's helpful too. We can say, okay, it's not neoplastic. You're actually reacting to something that's going on here. Did you just jerk out the antibody source? You probably did, or at least some of it. Reactive conditions, by definition, are non-neoplastic. It's the normal process of responding to infectious agent or a necrosis or something like that. We might see increase in numbers of follicles. When we say follicles, we're talking germinal centers here. We might see a lot of expansion of the sinusoidal stuff. It depends on the kind of response, the kind of stimulus that's going on. And then very specific kinds of inflammatory patterns, abscess, granuloma, that sort of thing, which are infectious in nature, obviously, and recognizable whether they're in a lymph node or somewhere else. Now, neoplastic disease means it's really a tumor. It's a growth. We really don't make a distinction. There is no such thing that I'm not aware of anything that's a benign lymph node growth, a benign lymph node tumor. Everything that's growing that replaces a lymph node, in my book, is malignant. Some may be very slow and indolent, but it's malignant. So we classify neoplastic disease so that we can have very predictable treatment options all over the country, and the protocols have been worked out very well, and so it's important that everybody's talking the same language. A pathologist in Bloomington Hospital sees a lymph node, we microscopically look at it. We're going to be telling exactly the same story that somebody will be telling, say, in Los Angeles or something. We'll be describing it the same way. We'll all have the same standard. When we take a look at the CD markers on the surface, we're all looking at the same kind of thing. We all know what it is. So the histologic pattern is very important, and we're going to start talking about the distinction between Hodgkin and non-Hodgkin lymphomas. And importantly, we're going to take a look at staging. So the histologic pattern tells us what is the cell that's gone malignant. It happened a long time. Maybe it happened 2 years ago. It's just taken a while for it to grow to the point of becoming evident. So we want to see the histologic pattern to say what's the type. The stage is very important here. That is the extent of spread, and that's probably the most important thing. Is it confined to one or two lymph nodes, or is it all over the body and in the spleen and everywhere else? So stage is very important. Histologic grade is how aggressive do the cells look. Stage is more important than grade, believe it or not. Extent of spread is more important than how aggressive the thing looks. So you want to understand the difference between stage and grade. We sometimes talk about what is sometimes called B symptoms. And that is, was the person, they came forward and they said, I got this lump in my neck here and that's all, it's hard. An inflammatory thing is going to be painful. Rubor, dolor, calor, right? Tumor, right? But this thing is a slow, indolent growth and it's hard, it's painless, it's not red. And typically it is very hard, like they shoved a marble under there. Poke around all you want. So a tumor does not have rubor, dolor, calor, that sort of business. So when we talk about B symptoms, we're talking about what we call constitutional symptoms or generalized symptoms. Did the person have weight loss? Did the person have night sweats? Did they have unexplained fevers? Things like that. And this is kind of a curious thing. Why do we call them B symptoms? Are there A symptoms? And no, there aren't. The way it worked was when they originally were looking at this and publishing papers, they said there was the absence of these things. Absence of A. The presence of it was B. There are no such things as A symptoms. The A symptoms mean absence of the B symptoms. It's a crazy kind of thing, but we talk about B symptoms. We're talking about these constitutional things that aren't really related to the mass, well, they are indirectly related to the mass itself. So there ain't no such thing as A symptoms. A referred to as absence of these guys. So when we go to establish or determine what's the diagnosis, what's going to happen, how are we going to treat this person, all these things have to come into play in terms of what's the cell type, what's the extent of spread, what's the grade, and the absence or presence of constitutional symptoms. And that is applied across the board to all forms. Yeah. Stage is extent of spread. How many lymph nodes does it involve? Where does it go? Did it get into the bone marrow? grade refers to how embryonic and aggressive do the individual cells appear cytologically. All right, so we're back to this. Well, here's what I want to point out to you. So if you take a look, if we had a high power view of this, we'd find out that in these germinal centers, there's a lot of action going on. There's a lot of cell replication. And if a malignant cell arises from inside here, it's cytologically going to look different. Because remember what happens here is that this thing is now going to be cloned. Whatever stage of maturation it was, whatever level of activity it had, at that point, it is fixed in time, and it simply reproduces its own kind now endlessly. And they all look exactly like themselves. They're cloned. So if we had a malignancy arise from inside here, from a cell in the germinal center, it would look quite a bit different than a cell that arose from right out here. These are very mature cells out here. If it arose from that, it would be a much smaller cell. It wouldn't have the histologic features of this. It wouldn't probably be as rapidly growing either. And so understanding where the malignant cell, at least the possibilities of where these malignant cells can come from, tells us what the thing is going to look like. If it comes from sort of a germinal center, it's going to try and make little follicles. It thinks it's supposed to be a germinal center, even though it's a really screwed up one. It tries it. If it comes from right out in here, it could care less. Every neighbor was always spread out kind of equal. If you take a look here, all these that blue stuff, these all lymphocyte nuclei. And so it's a very diffuse pattern. So the histologic pattern and the cytology of the cells determine what it's going to look like, and that is determined by where it came from within that. A little bit like leukemias. We looked at acute leukemias and the appearance of it determined on at what point the thing became malignant. Where did that malignant cell arise from? All right, now we're going to start with non-Hodgkin lymphomas. Probably should have started with Hodgkin's because Hodgkin's have a defining cell feature, but anyway, non-Hodgkin lymphomas are pretty darn common, particularly in my age group and older. And what you will notice here is, if you take a look, there's a section of a lymph node over there, roughly the same power as the other, that reactive one we saw a moment ago, and it's effaced. We're only seeing a little wedge of it. But there's no structure left there. You don't see any germinal centers. You don't see anything. It's completely overrun and replaced by cells that look like this. They're quite homogeneous. They're very similar. They're all B cells virtually always. And they're very long life. This is a malignancy arising from these memory cells. These guys have been hanging around for a long time. They've had a lot of exposure to oxidative injury and little bits of radiation and God knows what. And they've gotten bored, I suppose. You know, they're sitting there waiting for something to happen. I'm remembering what it was when this guy was 4 years old and he had some kind of cold. You know what I mean? So I'm supposed to sit around here and do nothing the rest of my life except just remember that. Well, I'm tired of it. And so it takes off and, you know, takes a few pot shots at its neighbors. I don't know what it does. At any rate, it begins to proliferate. It becomes malignant, and it grows very slowly. And it came from that zone of the lymph node where all the neighbors were spread out, you know, very mature. It didn't come from the heart of a germinal center, so it doesn't have that inclination. And it just simply grows as a continuous, slow-growing sheet. This is the kind of tumor that my group will die with rather than of as a general rule. It's almost impossible because it grows so slowly. The chemotherapy, you can't really get a toehold on some kind of metabolic action. And they look exactly like each other. And they all came from some kind of memory cell. And every now and then they'll start making immunoglobulins even, you know. So at any rate, this would be an example of a non-Hodgkin lymphoma. A very diffuse pattern. Probably the person just had this hard nodule or maybe two in the neck and said, hey, what's going on here? And say, are you having night sweats, fevers? Do you feel bad? And the answer is, nah, not really. Chronic lymphocytic leukemia. When we talked about chronic lymphocytic leukemia and I said it was kind of on a spectrum, that was a mature B cell leukemia, which was a liquid phase tumor. This is basically the same tumor, but it's a solid phase. It arose, instead of arising from the bone marrow, where some memory cells live, lives, it arose from a lymph node. And it kind of wants to grow and stay in the lymph node. And actually, they kind of slide back and forth, kind of the same tissue type and appearance. Thank you. Well, look at this. Here's a different lymphoma. This is one that arose from This is a follicular lymphoma. Again, it's non-Hodgkin's. It arose from some kind of cell that was at the heart of one of those germinal centers. And in that case, it continues to grow. It's an embryonic, it's a very aggressive, and I mean, it's a cell that's, wants to grow kind of quickly. And look at this. You might say, well, actually, those look a lot like germinal centers to me. And that's true, they do, because it knows that's where it came from. It kind of wants to form. Its neighbors want to kind of organize into a group like that. But those are not healthy. Those are malignant cells. These are. If we had a whole section of the lymph node, we would see that the overall architecture is completely gone. The idea of that sort of sinusoids coming in, tubes coming in, sinusoids going through it, exiting, all that crap's gone. And everything has been completely overrun by this. And so we refer to that as a nodular or follicular lymphoma. Now we call it centrocytic because it comes from a germinal center. We understand that the cell that gave rise to it was one in here that mutated and became malignant. And I will say that it's probably pretty evident here that these cells really are not quite uniform, so much as identical cells as one from the next, but they're all malignant. And that is from looking into one of those follicles there. So this is a different variety, but once again, most of these are B-cell malignancies. Here is a form of lymphoma that we see relatively often in Africa. We do have a version of it here in the New World called Burkitt's lymphoma, and the malignant cell is actually relatively sparse. These guys in here, these are cells that are right out of the heart of that germinal center, the cell that was responding to some kind of antigenic stimulus, and it became malignant at that moment. Something occurred to it. And when we talk about a starry sky appearance, we have the background here, and the we see the stars, which have to be holes, the light holes from these immunoblasts peeping through. This is very likely associated with Epstein-Barr virus and lots of things. Epstein-Barr, which is the virus of mononucleosis, yes? Yes. And that infects not only your throat epithelium, but also the B cells. And so when we see people who have B cell malignancies, often we will find EB virus stuff in there. This is one that involves in children the jaw. It's very common in Africa in that area. In the New World, we have something that looks very similar and apparently is very similar, but it tends to involve lymph nodes in the retroperitoneum. One of my friends was in Africa. He goes to Africa fairly often. He's at a school. Took this picture for me of all these kids waiting for treatment and diagnosis. Very common malignancy there. You can see these little boys have this huge jaw lesion. It does respond pretty well to radiation and chemotherapy, but you got to get them in. You got to be able to do that, and that's one of the things that the delivery system isn't quite so good. But at any rate, I said, Tal, I need a picture of kids with Burkitt's lymphoma, and so he didn't have any trouble producing one for me. So it's actually in the bone. It arises in the bone of the jaw in that situation, and it's unquestionably related, in my mind, related to an Epstein-Barr viral infection of the B lymphocytes, these early pre-B lymphocytes, and they become malignant. Now, I've been ballyhooing business between Hodgkin's and non-Hodgkin's. We looked at non-Hodgkin lymphomas. What the heck is a Hodgkin's lymphoma? Hodgkin's lymphoma is, to me, one of the strangest things there is. When we take a look at a person who has Hodgkin's lymphoma, what they actually have is an unholy war that's going on in their system between the T and the B cells. The malignant cell is capable of starting a revolution. And when we take a look at the lymphocyte, we look at the lymph node, it is completely effaced, or almost completely effaced, overrun by the battlefield. And what's driving it is the Reed-Sternberg cell. You want to have this. I have never sent over questions without a picture of a Reed-Sternberg cell, okay? And asking, and I never sent over questions without asking the difference between stage and grading. You ask that question, you want to know that, okay? The odds are I'll do it again. I don't know what I'm going to feel like next week, but you know, if I'm feeling crappy, you'll know it. You'll probably recognize it when the test rolls around. But at any rate, the Reed-Sternberg cell is a malignant cell. It is probably a B cell. It is binucleate, or at least lobed. It has two huge owl-eyed nucleoli that kind of stare out at you like owl eyes, you know. And this is the malignant cell. And that malignant cell has to be, listen carefully, please. The malignant cell has to be in the correct background. we can see reactive cells occasionally, particularly lymph nodes that are stimulated by a viral infection. We can see cells that look a little bit like this, but they're not, because they're not in the proper background. What is the proper background? The proper background is battlefield. The proper background includes eosinophils. Here you go, there's an eosinophil. Lymphocytes, plasma cells, healthy, benign lymphocytes and plasma cells. What the Reed-Sternberg cell represents, we have a lymph node that is completely shot and destroyed. Only 5% of the mass of that lymph node is malignant cells. If we took a look at non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, everything is. It's clonal proliferation, overgrowth of the whole shoot and match by malignant cells. Here, only 5% of the mass of that lymph node, which is completely destroyed, is the malignant cell. What the malignant cell is capable of doing is stimulating a war, and it literally is a war between the T and the B cells. It's like Armageddon. And it's like Armageddon, and you're going to die, baby cakes. You're going to die if we don't take care of this thing. It's that simple. It's your age group. It's a bimodal age group. You see it in your age group, and then picking up again in the late 40s and on into my age group. Okay? If it's recognized early, it's treatable, it's curable, that's the end of the story. If it's not recognized early, not treated, you're going to die, end of story. So what we see then is that it is the burnout of the immune system that this sucker is able to bring about. And it typically spreads from lymph node to lymph node. And so here staging is extremely important. And this is where the whole concept of staging came along. It subsequently was generalized to all lymphomas, but it was done here. And this is where the whole idea of B symptoms came along. And then it was generalized to other malignancies. That's the malignant cell. That's a healthy cell. That's a healthy cell. That's a healthy. That's a healthy. There's only one malignant cell in that whole field. That's it. And yet everybody is being induced to undergo this battle to the end. Sometimes the Reed-Sternberg cells look a little funny. They look a little bit like popcorns right there. These three are malignant cells. Everything else in that field is benign, yet has been stimulated to undergo. And so it's going to kill it. It's going to kill everything. These are called lacunar cells. They're kind of a variant of the Reed-Sternberg cell. So as a bimodal distribution, it is comparatively common. I would say we diagnose a case of this every other week or so over at Bloomington Hospital. There are different patterns, which include a lot of purely lymphocytes. There's a mixed cell pattern. And these are things that are, this is the battlefield. What does the battlefield look like? Does it consist mostly of mature lymphocytes? Does it have histiocytes in it? But all of these features do have to be present in some percentage. The battlefield has to look like that. So this, we will be looking at how many lymph nodes do we have involvement. The staging will be, are they on both sides of the diaphragm or only on one? Is there splenic involvement? Is there bone marrow involvement, which is saying that this thing has really gotten away from us and the likelihood of complete recovery is not very good. Yeah?
So if you see that kind of cell and it's not in the correct background, does that mean it's not that kind of cell that you think it is, or is it not malignant?
Both of those, yes. More than likely, it's not that cell and it's not malignant. What it generally would mean in my case would be when I would see that and I couldn't convince myself of it, first thing I did is I sent it out for somebody else to take a look at. I'd send it up to Mayo Clinic. I'd say, what do you think about this? I would send them the tissue as well, so we could, if we needed to do particular studies to look for markers on the surface of it, they would do it. Plenty of mistakes are made. Most times the mistakes are made in the direction where it's benign, but we think it's malignant. People undergo more extensive surgery, workup, sometimes even chemotherapy. Yeah, and then we pull the cork and say, ultimately, what's going to happen is this. This lymph node here is developing a lot of scar tissue. All the inflammatory, the lymphokines and things like that are going to drive the healthy macrophages to induce collagen production, and eventually all the lymph nodes are going to scar down, the bone marrow is going to scar down, and that's the end of it. Here you see one malignant cell. Here's a couple. There's one. We only get to see one nucleus. Here's one. All the other cells in here, lots of eosinophils, all the other are soldiers that have been induced to come to battle for no particular reason. Eventually, it's going to start looking like this, and then in time, it's all scar tissue. That's the story of Hodgkin's, one of the most peculiar malignancies there is. When we stage it, I do want you to understand that. I talked about staging. Now, we apply the staging to all lymphomas now, but it was developed for Hodgkin's disease. Stage one, it's confined to a single lymph node. Stage two, it's two lymph nodes, but on the same side of the diaphragm. Stage three, it's on both sides of the diaphragm. It may have some splenic involvement or just a little bit of an extra nodal extension. Number four is it's all over the place. It's in the liver. It's in the bone marrow. It's pretty advanced. So that would be how we stage it. And looking at the histologic type is going to determine the kind of therapy that they're going to use. All right, let's see where we are here. I'm going to back up for a moment because I didn't have some pictures, some slides. If we go back to in the notes, you'll notice I have classes of lymphomas under the non-Hodgkin category called low-grade, intermediate-grade, and high-grade. And again, those are things, it's not in the images, I didn't have one slide made of that, but it's in the notes packet. And those apply, yeah.
People that have Hodgkin's lymphoma and have been treated for it, are they left with a lot of scarring?
Yes, they are. And they're left with some other problems too. And that they have about a 6% chance, that is 6, not 60, but a 6% chance of developing another hematologic malignancy later in life. They tend to, again, but the flip side of that is 94% don't. So with you, you know. There is some scarring, but it tends not to impede normal immune processing later. It really doesn't lead to problems. If you're looking at the notes, you will just see that I talk about classes of non-Hodgkin's lymphomas, low-grade, high-grade, intermediate-grade. And again, the grade refers to how embryonic and aggressive appearing the individual cells are. So I do want you to understand the difference between grade and stage. And I just see that's a little bit different in the notes than what I had for slides. Let's go ahead here to almost the last thing. I mentioned that most of these lymphomas are B-cell malignancies. Again, B-cells hang around for a long time. We have the B-cells make antibodies, right? Ultimately, the maturest of all B-cell is a plasma cell, right? That's the end of the line, apart from memory B-cells. But that's the end of the line is the plasma cell. And that's got to be busy making antibodies. And they hang around and hang around and hang around. Because if they don't, if we lose our antibodies, for example, if you pee them all out, if you have a kidney disease and you lose proteins and you're peeing out a lot of proteins, you're peeing out your antibodies. And then all of a sudden you get infections you shouldn't be getting. You shouldn't be immune to them because, you know. So antibody levels can drop off. You maintain a certain level of antibodies all your life, maybe to every little thing you had, I don't know. But B cells hang around for a long time. So those are the guys that we do see producing malignancies later. And this is an example. This is a malignancy that shows up in my age group above the age of 60. And it is a true malignancy of a plasma cell. Again, plasma cells, some of them have been around for 30, 40 years, maybe longer. And so, I mean, they have been hit by a lot of potential mutagens. And the end result is that every now and then one of them comes up, becomes malignant and just continues to grow. And it may start making an antibody. It may start producing a full antibody. It may produce, maybe if it's really a damaged cell, it may produce only a light chain or a heavy chain. It may produce fragments of it. It can do a lot of stuff. This is a plasma cell malignancy. And it distributes itself in the bone marrow. That tends to be where they arise. And you can see here in the skull of this person looks really kind of ratty. Over here it's maybe a little bit clearer because it's the light on this guy. But you can see the skull, it's got holes shot through it, and those are areas of bone resorption from the proliferating little foci of these plasma cells. Again, this takes several years. This didn't happen overnight. People will have fractured bones. They'll fracture their spine, easy fracture, because there's bone erosion because they get so much replaced with these malignant plasma cells. Here's a plasma cell you'd all recognize for what it is. Actually, a fair number of them, by the way, are binucleate. Our normal healthy plasma cells, but here's an example of one that's not healthy. It's binucleate, and it's all full of something, and it's busy making antibody, but it's malignant, and it's constantly growing. And so one of the things that happens, two things really are occurring here, or several things are with this. One is that you're replacing the healthy bone marrow with this malignant population. Okay, this is an old song we've heard over and over in here. So the more it gets replaced, the worse it becomes for everybody else that's in there. So in my age group, if somebody came in and was anemic, and it was just a regular anemia, not a deficiency state or something, almost always it's related to bone marrow replacement with myeloma. This is the term that we use. Multiple myeloma. Oma is a body. These are many bone marrow bodies. That's what that word, that's what that term means. Many bone marrow bodies. The myeloma is the oma, the little bitty bodies. And what we're looking at here in this x-ray, and more or less in this x-ray, is the effect of that on the bone, that eats away the bone. So there's bone marrow replacement, but also you have a lot of, typically, fragments of antibodies being produced. So there's a tremendous amount of protein being manufactured, much of which is being peed out in the urine. It's small enough that it goes right on through the sieve of the glomerulus. And so you're losing, you're in a net negative nitrogen balance. You just can't eat enough cheeseburgers to keep up with this thing. So you're losing protein. You've got replacement of the bone marrow, the healthy bone marrow with this. You've got bone erosions and things of that kind. And then there are potentially a host of problems that can occur because of the immunoglobulin itself in terms of sticking to other cells, sticking to endothelial cells, and so on, and especially coating platelets. And so even if we have an adequate number of platelets, we find out they don't work for crap. And they don't work because they get coated with this screwy protein that the fragment of the immunoglobulin is being made. We can determine that. We can see if we saw a picture like this, first thing we want to do is get a blood sample and a urine sample and do a protein electrophoresis to see, is there a screwy protein there? And I'll show you what that looks like here. This is a electrophoresis, and what it's showing here is our patient over here, and we also have, our patient's down here, and up here is a normal for comparison. And we take a small amount of the plasma in this case, and we put it on an electrophoretic strip, maybe paper or a gel, and then, you know, expose it. You know how this stuff works, right? Expose it to an electric field so it separates the proteins based on charge. And what we're looking for. So we've all got a bunch of albumin, and here's alpha 1, alpha 2. And you'll see in the healthy person, we all have a gamma, a bunch of gammas. All these antibodies that have been around for a long time, the ones we count on for our long-time immunity. Here's somebody with multiple myeloma. Here's their albumin, alpha 1, alpha 2. And look at their gamma. All the gamma is one type of protein. It's a clonal production of protein. And if we take a look at what makes up the immunoglobulins, whether it's IgG, IgA, IgM, we also look at the kappa and lambda light chains, what we discover here is it is all one gamma and it's all kappa type light chain. And they vary all over the place. It can be all IgG and lambda, can be only kappa or lambda, and it's not an intact protein. And so what's happening is that these plasma cells are just cranking out, producing buckets and buckets of protein. You're peeing it all out. They're occupying the bone marrow. They're destroying the bone. Your normal healthy myelopoietic tissue is being squeezed out of the picture. And you can't eat enough cheeseburgers to keep up with the amount of protein this thing is inducing you to pee away. So that's the story of multiple myeloma. It is a malignant proliferation of plasma cells, essentially a terminally mature B cell. Huge gamma. It tends to be where it is right there. And it's pretty darn common. I can tell you, in my age group, it's pretty common. B-cell malignancies, whether it's lymphomas, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or the solid lymphoma like we looked at, or it's this, this is where it starts to happen to all of us at this age because they've simply been hanging around so darn long. Multiple myeloma. Waldenstrom's, by the way, which I have in the notes here, Waldenstrom's is a form of malignancy which involves the IgMs. And what happens there is because, remember, IgMs are big pentameric antibody aggregates. When you get a lot of that stuff around, the blood becomes very, very thick. And it makes it very hyperviscous. And blood can't be pumped. IgM, Waldenstrom's and IgM myeloma is actually two quite slightly different things. That's kind of uncommon. That we don't see as much. So this is the pretty much standard fare right there. My age group. This is kind of a Rorschach test. Alrighty? If you take a look at this, and what you see when you look at that are two porpoises leaping out of the water, everything is fine. Life is fine. You're good. Go about your daily business, okay? If you see anything other than two porpoises leaping, you need to go home right now, go back to bed, get some extra sleep, and get a decent meal, all right? Something's really wrong. All right. That's it for hematology. Again, a week from Thursday, those lectures will be recorded. The renal lectures will be online. Won't be here, all right? What you could do is play them right here, and you could set some kind of, sock puppet up here and do it if you wanted. That'd be kind of hip. That's it, friends.